Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Last night at a campaign rally in South Carolina, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump took a drastic stance concerning immigration and refugees.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. You have no choice.
This morning, Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz said that he disagrees with Trump's proposal, and then he announced his own.
We need a plan that is focused on the direct threat, and the threat we're facing is radical Islamic terrorism. It's why I've introduced legislation focused on suspending for 3 years, putting in place a moratorium on refugees from countries where ISIS or Al-Qaeda controls substantial territory, because that is the threat we're facing.
Whether they agree with those ideas or find them abhorrent, many Americans are asking how we might prevent domestic terrorism motivated by Islamic extremism without penalizing innocent people. Here to talk about these most recent suggestions by the Republican presidential frontrunners is Ron Elving. He is NPR's senior Washington editor. Ron, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Would you agree that these statements from Donald Trump and from Ted Cruz demonstrate that this has become the prime topic of conversation on the presidential campaign trail?
Yes, and it had really already with the Paris attacks of November 13th. Then that was, of course, greatly expanded and intensified by what happened in San Bernardino. You know, Southern California is an awfully long way away from what we think of as the Middle East, as what we think of as the battlefield right now in terms of these religious wars, these wars against terrorism. Even Paris, of course, seemed remote, although there are such large populations of people from that part of the world who have relocated in Western Europe that it was a little less surprising that this should happen. To see this happen in Southern California was a real shock to many Americans, and people are asking, as we heard Donald Trump asking, what is going on? What is being done to protect us?
Cruz's legislation, known as the State Refugee Security Act, would essentially give more authority to the states to decide how they deal with refugees that the federal government has pledged to resettle. It suggests a 3-year moratorium on refugees from countries that ISIS and Al-Qaeda control, giving authorities to states to opt out from receiving refugees, U.S. states, and removing U.S. citizenship from Americans who travel overseas to join ISIS. Do you think something like this or elements of this proposal can gain momentum in Congress?
Yes, I do, especially, of course, considering that in the House of Representatives, the Republicans have a controlling majority, and in the Senate, with a little help from some of the Democrats, they can have a working majority in the Senate, and they can put something on the president's desk. Now, as we're going to see with the repeal of Obamacare bill that they have passed this week, the president can veto anything that he wants to veto, and it's not likely that they'll be able to override that in the Congress, but they can at least put it forward, they can advance it, and they can force a negotiation with the president for him to adopt at least some of their ideas.
There is already a mechanism for denaturalization of naturalized U.S. citizens. I had not realized that until I started looking into it this morning. But in fact, there is a law that says that a naturalized U.S. citizen who belongs to a subversive group, and I suppose a terrorist group would be included in that, can be removed. Is there a reason to sort of restate this in a new law?
That would be probable, that they would restate it so that it seemed a little less like a era of the Cold War type piece of legislation, a little less ideological perhaps, and maybe a little bit more leaning towards the association with groups such as ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Some of that gets pretty close to being a religious test, and that's a problem in terms of the Constitution and in terms of most constitutional law and international treaties to which the United States is signatory that rule out that sort of thing. Now, of course, Mr. Trump's proposal is quite clearly an abrogation of those kinds of treaties, and possibly, at least depending on how it was applied to American citizens who are Muslims but who may be out of the country at the moment, possibly not constitutional in and of itself. But Mr. Cruz's proposal, Senator Cruz's proposal, and I believe Governor Abbott is in support of this legislation, is different. It's somewhat more limited. It doesn't focus on the religion of the people who might be excluded. It focuses more on their origin in a country where these groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are dominant.
How do you define where these groups are dominant, though? And there are certainly regions that are controlled by terrorist groups around the world, whereas, legitimate governments or elected governments have control elsewhere. I mean, is anyone talking about the particulars of these details?
They would probably just need to go ahead and name the countries, as Senator Cruz has done, naming Syria, of course, Yemen, Libya, a couple of other countries. Those are countries that are in such tumult and torment right now, it's hard to know who is dominant at any given time. And that word is probably going to have to be debated. We're going to have to talk about whether we're talking about an operation in a given country or whether the influence of ISIS seems to be truly dominant in that particular country. You might want to say that about one, but not about another. And there is going to have to be a lot of debate over that. But once they have decided on their terms, someone would have to make the designation, presumably the State Department would have to make the designation of a given country as off limits, and people coming from those countries would then be excluded. That is a somewhat different kettle of fish, however, and much more limited one than merely saying that anyone of the Muslim faith could not enter the United States.
Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are getting a lot of attention today talking about these issues. Does this mean that the other Republican candidates, at the very least, will have to submit their own plans?
I believe they're going to have to at least be prepared to ask or answer a question about how they stand on the Trump proposal, which I think has found its way into the popular imagination rather quickly. And they may not be pressed on exactly where their details were the same or different from Senator Cruz's. But the Trump proposal is going to be front and center, certainly for the rest of this week. One would expect that a week from tonight, when the candidates meet again for their last debate of this year, that this will be question one, and it might be the dominant question throughout the entire debate, that we have a nation in great anxiety and even raw fear because of these latest incidents. They have not been reassured by President Obama and his prescription for how we are going to defeat ISIS in the long run. It isn't reassuring enough, certainly in the short run. And so this is what the people are demanding at the moment. And these Republican candidates are, of course, responding to that demand from the political market.
What about the Democrats, the candidates seeking the Democratic nomination? What sort of response have we heard from Hillary Clinton, from Bernie Sanders?
Bernie Sanders is usually less than eager to get into these kinds of discussions, but of course he's condemned these attacks, he's condemned the violence, he's said that we need to have another look at assault weapons. Hillary Clinton has also endorsed the idea that we heard from President Obama on Sunday night, that anyone on a no-fly list, these are people who would be restricted if they went to the airport, try to get on an airplane, should not be allowed to buy a firearm, and that they should be put in that same category with other people who are not allowed to buy firearms. There are also proposals abroad among Democratic candidates and other Democrats to limit people's access to what are sometimes called assault weapons, such as the AR-15s that were used in the San Bernardino shooting, and some other kinds of weapons. So we will hear more on the gun control front. We will hear more on the visa waiver program front. That's probably one where Republicans and Democrats can get together on at least adjusting the program by which people come to this country without a visa and therefore with less vetting before they arrive here.
I thought it was interesting the other night that the president used the phrase gun safety rather than gun control. That sounds like something we haven't heard as much in the past.
That's right. And that is really the phrase now for people who support greater legislative restriction on firearms. They don't talk about gun control so much anymore because that term seems to, in polling, excite more opposition than the idea of gun safety. Who can be against gun safety, after all? But if you use the word control, then obviously people begin to feel that their Second Amendment rights might be in jeopardy.
All right, let's listen here. On Sunday, President Obama called for American Muslims to help root out extremism themselves.
If we're to succeed in defeating terrorism, we must enlist Muslim communities as some of our strongest allies, rather than push them away. through suspicion and hate.
What kind of response are we hearing? What reaction from Muslim Americans to the president's request for their help?
Most Muslim Americans, I think, are quite eager to help. They're quite eager to put an end to the suspicion, quite eager to do whatever they can to prevent this kind of violence from happening again and being blamed, obviously, on people who are their co-religionists. They may not have much in common with the two people in San Bernardino, but they do have Islam in common. And even with all of its interpretations, from the outside, that is a label that people are going to see and not see past. So most Muslim Americans are quite eager to do whatever they can to help the government crack down on any of this kind of violence. They know how deleterious it is to their situation. They know how damaging it is to their people in the long run, even in the short run. But all it takes, as we've seen, you can frustrate 100 plots, 1,000 plots, but if one plot, and in this case apparently involving just a husband and wife, we haven't even found a third person who is involved in the conspiracy thus far, if that is the case, it's going to be extremely difficult to get inside that conspiracy and frustrate it. So all it takes is one incident and people begin to feel as though they're truly not safe. You know, the president's other point here is that if we continue to villainize people on the basis of their religion or to bar them from the United States on the basis of their religion, we will not get the cooperation from Muslim Americans that we very much need, and we will have that much more animosity with the world of Islam beyond our borders.
Have we ever barred immigrants on the basis of religion alone?
Not strictly. I don't believe there was the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882 that excluded Chinese and also greatly restricted the rights of those Chinese who were already in the country. That had such a cultural element to it that it would in some respects be akin to religion. We also refused to let some refugees come to the United States in the late 1930s who were on ships waiting offshore to come here during the rise of Hitler in Europe. And that had to do certainly with at least some suspicion of at least some of those refugees based on their being Jewish. That's a very sad and desperate story in American history and one that's much been regretted since then. But to lay out a blanket and say no one of this faith, there were suggestions of holding Catholics out of the country back in the middle 1800s, but obviously that back before the Civil War and the dim, dark ages of American history seems quite remote today.
How do you see the conversation continuing to play out between the states who, like Texas Governor Greg Abbott, have come out to oppose the Obama administration's plan to resettle refugees, the states and the federal government?
This will be ongoing for years to come, I suspect, whether the refugees are from Syria or from somewhere else. The federal government has the cards here in terms of constitutional law, but the states have to cooperate for the programs to be effective, for the people to be settled successfully. So really, neither side can entirely ignore the other, and therefore the pas de deux will go on, no matter how ugly it may be at times. It has to be a dance between the two levels of government.
Ron Elving, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Chris.
Coming up after a short break, we will talk with Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU, about how past presidents have handled questions facing our current leaders. If you would like to be part of this conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Senator and presidential candidate Ted Cruz want a 3-year moratorium on refugees from countries controlled by ISIS or Al-Qaeda and want Americans stripped of their citizenship if they leave the country to support a terrorist organization. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump wants the U.S. to put a moratorium on any Muslims entering the United States until, as he says, we figure out what's going on in the wake of a mass shooting last week in San Bernardino, California. Joining us to continue our discussion about the implications of all of these developments, we have Jeffrey Engel. He is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and author. He is author of the upcoming book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Well, let's start with the history of things. You've been writing about how President Roosevelt was challenged to fight fascist and Nazi ideology in the lead up to our entrance into World War II. Are there parallels in the way that FDR crafted his strategy that are useful here to understand what's going on?
Well, one of the important parallels is that people, of course, were concerned to the point of fear. And when an American population is fearful, then their politicians typically respond with high drama and with high rhetoric. And one of the things that Roosevelt was particularly effective at was calming the fears, explaining to people the stakes at hand, which in his case were the stakes of a global conflict, a global conflict of epic proportions, frankly, a lot more difficult in terms of to manage than we have today. But Roosevelt was very, very good about calming fears, getting people to realize that they too had a stake in solving the problem, but that the problems were solvable. They didn't need to go screaming into the night. They just had to work their problems through.
Of course, one of the things he did to calm fears was to intern tens of thousands of Japanese Americans who had done nothing wrong.
That is true. And of course, you know, history has shown quite clearly that that was the wrong thing to do, not only legally, in that the Supreme Court, of course, ruled that that was illegal, but also morally. There's really very little support for that idea that Roosevelt did the right thing in that case. When we start tallying the good points and the bad points of his presidency, that's one that always goes in the bad side.
Candidate Trump has cited FDR in some of his ideas. Is that appropriate? Are there ways in which what he is proposing actually reflects what FDR did?
I think it's actually entirely inappropriate and an entire misread of history for two reasons. First, because as I just mentioned a moment ago, this is not something that Roosevelt was proud of. This is something that he and those around him recognized was a mistake. So for Donald Trump to tout Roosevelt for something that Roosevelt would have considered one of the worst things he ever did, that's seems a little far-fetched to me. But secondly, and more importantly, one of the things that Roosevelt was particularly concerned with was making sure that everybody had one of the four freedoms that he said was the driving force for the war, which was freedom of religion, that we do not become an American because of who you pray to. You become an American because you share in certain values and ideals. And anyone from any religion, from any creed is available to join the United States, in Roosevelt's opinion. And one of the things that he was concerned about, of course, was keeping people away from fear. Freedom from fear, of course, was one of his major planks. But the fear also, to have people be free from fear, they also had to be free from worry about their neighbors. And Roosevelt was really effective at making sure that people knew that Americans were all in this together, aside from the mistake that he made of interning the Japanese.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. When Donald Trump and Senator Ted Cruz, who we'll talk about in a minute, suggest these bans on refugees, it's in the context that this is a national security issue. Is there a less charged way to discuss the security concerns that some Americans indeed have about allowing refugees into the country from places in the world where there is a great deal of trouble at the moment?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize about refugees is that they don't come from nice places. You know, the very fact that they are trying to flee and trying to flee usually very quickly suggests to us that this is a place where there is trouble. I mean, that's sort of obvious. So we shouldn't be surprised that people who are coming to the United States and to Europe in need of help, frankly, need help. And so what we need to recognize is that everybody who would come to the United States, the very, very minute handful of people who have come to the United States and who are projected to come to the United States as refugees, in comparison to the hundreds of thousands that have come to Europe, the minute handful that would come here are all going to be screened, are all going to be looked at. There's nobody who's going to arrive as a surprise. And we can see that really geographically. I mean, it's possible to sail across the Mediterranean from Turkey to Greece to get into Europe because it's a relatively small body of water. Nobody is sailing across the Atlantic to come here. For somebody to arrive here, they have to come from a plane. And anyone who's gone through customs these days know there's somebody who's looking at you when you get off that plane. So we don't really need to worry about people coming unaware and unannounced as they do in Europe.
Are there things that we can learn from the way that Europe handles things, particularly in the wake of the Paris attacks? There has been some, much greater concern about security. A lot of people are questioning whether it was a bad idea to allow in the volume of refugees who have resettled there.
You know, the French actually have a longer standing problem with integrating their own Muslim culture. And in fact, I think that that is really the difficulty that is at the heart of what Trump and others are suggesting, that by identifying Islam as the problem,
Muslims the other.
Right. Making them the other. You're really doing ISIS's work for them. The one thing that ISIS really wants and that al-Qaeda wanted before them was to create essentially a war of civilizations, was to radicalize people in the Middle East, radicalize Muslims around the world, to see the United States and its allies as the enemy because they were going to victimize and attack Muslims. By victimizing and attacking Muslims, we're basically helping out their cause. We basically could not write better propaganda for ISIS than Donald Trump has just offered.
For quite some time, reading analyses of the intentions of ISIS, it seemed that they were focused almost exclusively on sort of building this caliphate and that they would not be a terrorist threat to the United States or its allies. That's apparently not the case anymore. Is it possible to say what has changed? Is it simply the fact that people who happen to live elsewhere are looking at what ISIS is doing and saying, I want to be part of that, and I want to be part of that from wherever it is that I reside?
Well, I think to understand that, we need to take a look back and say, what is the purpose of terrorism? No one is suggesting that any terrorist attack, be it in Paris or in San Bernardino, is possibly going to destroy and take over the United States government. So this is not a classic military confrontation in the sense of trying to acquire and control land. Instead, what these are really propaganda and better understood as marketing attacks. And because ISIS was suffering tremendously on the battlefield in Syria at the moment, because they're having a tremendous difficulty maintaining their state, by radicalizing people elsewhere, or more importantly, by getting people in France, in the Western world, in the United States to view ISIS as an enemy, they're basically doing self-promotion, if you will, that they're getting exactly the attention that they want and therefore getting resources from others around the world to help out the ISIS and al-Qaeda cause. Because if you're a Muslim elsewhere in the world and you hear something like Donald Trump just said, or you hear the horrible, vehement attacks that have come out against Muslims in France in the recent weeks, that's a good reason to open your checkbook, if you will, or to send your sons to Syria.
All right, let's talk about Governor Greg Abbott's plans to resist efforts to resettle Syrian refugees in the United States and specifically in Texas. This morning, he and Senator Ted Cruz, also a leading candidate for the GOP presidential nomination, said they wanted to keep refugees from terrorist-controlled nations out of Texas. How exactly could they do that?
Well, they can't. I mean, the first thing is that they have no legal authority to do so. Now, obviously, that's the point of their legislation, is to try to change the way that we do things. This is a federal issue at first. But the second thing is, you know, once you get people in this country, unless you're going to actually put a tail on them and follow them 24/7, we don't have roadblocks and checkpoints across states. So somebody who would come to, let's say, Oklahoma could very easily come into Texas. So the idea that we're going to somehow wall off our state is, I think, not only offensive, frankly, and frankly contrary to the whole ethos of what it means to be an American, in my opinion. But more importantly, it's fundamentally ineffective. And as I said before, there is nobody who's going to come to the United States as a refugee from these areas who hasn't already been screened by the FBI and screened by the government. So this is something which I think people are really taking out of context in many ways. They're making this a bigger issue than it really should be.
When you say it can't be done, I guess theoretically a law could be passed in Texas. But would this be the kind of thing something that would have to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, I think most definitely. Mm-hmm. Most definitely, especially since, you know, the Supreme Court is very clear that, the federal government trumps, no pun intended, trumps local law and trumps state law. So this is really, national security affairs are, for very good reason, not the domain of governors.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. All right, so I want to go back to something that we spoke about in the first segment, Ron Elving and I. Senator Cruz has called for this 3-year moratorium on refugees from countries controlled by ISIS or Al-Qaeda. I'm concerned about how this would be defined. How would the issue of a country controlled by a terrorist organization be defined? Would this be the kind of thing that could also be applied to countries that are run, say, by dictators?
Most definitely. In fact, I mean, definitions are really, really tricky in international affairs because they become immediately politicized. We know that the State Department is required by Congress, for example, to put out a list of states that are sponsors of terrorism or states that are in violation of what we consider to be normal human rights. And those always become very politicized. You know, do you want to say one of your major trading partners is a violator of human rights? Because once you do, once you say yes, put them in that category, it triggers certain events. So to say that a state in the Middle East or in Africa is controlled by ISIS or controlled by a terrorist organization is much, much more difficult than simply to say that a state has the presence of ISIS or the presence of Al-Qaeda. Now, were Ted Cruz and others to suggest that they want to keep people who are away, who are keep people from states where there is an influence of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, well, then you might actually have to say, well, you know, Senator Cruz, what that means is we can't have any immigration from California because clearly we've just seen some ISIS supporters in California. So consequently, if you're going to say that all we care about is influence, then I think you really shot yourself in the foot in terms of making effective legislation.
And what about this re-raising of the issue of denaturalization, which is on the books, as Ron Elving and I discussed, for, as sort of a communist-era thing, could be brought back. I suppose it remains on the books, but might be reiterated in law. This is a pretty rare thing.
Well, it's pretty rare, and frankly, it should be very, very frightening to anybody who is concerned about, as Ted Cruz says he is, about overreaching federal power. If you're concerned about the power of the state becoming too great, the first thing that you should be afraid of is a state that is willing to come in and selectively take away people's not only rights and privileges, but their rights of citizenship. Because once you take away a person's rights of citizenship, once you take away their 14th Amendment rights, as everyone born in this country innately has, well, then you can do whatever you want with them. You could put them in secret prisons. You could execute them. We don't have to afford human rights to the same constitutional rights, I should say, to anybody who is not a citizen. So for the state to come in and decide that we are going to selectively take away rights that are guaranteed from the by the Constitution from individuals should be a very scary step for people who are concerned about tyranny, because frankly, I would call it one of the first steps towards tyranny.
There is not, if I understand correctly, talk of taking away citizenship from natural-born citizens, but do you think that's a logical outgrowth of this kind of conversation?
I think it would have to be. I think it would have to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Before we move on from denaturalization, if this were to be practiced on a larger scale than it has been historically, do you have any idea of what kind of due process would be necessary to determine sort of who left the country to train with a terrorist group and who left for some other purpose? And, you know, when these groups are not by nature particularly open about their activities and who's a member?
I think it'd be a very slippery slope for guilt by association. I would be very uncomfortable if people were not only targeted based upon their travels, but also targeted based upon their associations. You know, just because you receive a phone call or just because your cousin receives a phone call doesn't necessarily mean that you share the same political views. And one of the things I think we need to take a step back here and really consider is the message that the United States, with all this debate, is sending to the rest of the world. We need to remember that the reason that the country works is because it's the kind of place that people want to come to. You know, you want to stick your finger up in the air and feel the wind and recognize, are people leaving or coming? Are they voting with their feet? And we're the kind of country that people want to get to. And frankly, this rhetoric is the kind of thing that's going to keep people who we want in the country, the best and the brightest of the world, keep them from thinking that this is a place that they want to make their futures. So if we're really concerned about the United States, not only in this conflict, but about the United States over the the course of the long 21st century to come, about remaining competitive, about remaining economically viable, about dealing with our competitors around the world. This is the kind of thing that can really shoot ourselves in the foot, because we're going to keep the best and the brightest from wanting to come here because that they're worried about their guilt by association. If you are a brilliant democracy-loving person from a part of the country that you feel is being targeted by politicians on the campaign trail, you might decide to go to England instead, or maybe you'll go to Japan, but you wouldn't come here.
Do you think the United States, with this kind of rhetoric, is unintentionally sending the message that we are terribly, terribly afraid of terrorism?
I think we're explicitly sending that message. I think it's the wrong message. And I think more importantly, it really it not only does the work of our enemies, but it gives them a greater value in the world than I think, frankly, that they deserve. Now, I don't mean to suggest that they're no problem whatsoever, but we hear candidates on the campaign trail, especially on the Republican side, referring to this as an existential crisis. I got to tell you, the Cold War was an existential crisis. Mm-hmm. When there are 20,000 nuclear weapons aimed at the United States that could blow away existence, yes, then I think that's the right phrase to use. But nothing that we have seen from ISIS, no matter how terrible and how horrible, in any way suggests that the United States and our allies are going to cease to exist. So we need to be careful about the rhetoric, lest we actually make our enemy look too strong.
Do you think at all that our sense that things are existential crises that might, in fact, you know, threaten limited numbers of us? And I don't want to make light, and I know you don't, of the threat to anyone in this country or anyone else. But is this a factor of our country becoming much more individualistic than it was a few generations ago? Do you think that we're not really willing to countenance any kind of risk?
You know, I think I was going to say, I think that's it. I think that we have a sense that we can control our universe and control our world. And what really terrifies us are not the everyday common dangers that are actually more dangerous than terrorism. I mean, I'm much more likely to have to die on the way back to campus, God forbid, but I'm much more likely to die on the way back to campus than I ever am from a terrorist attack. But we're not having a discussion on the radio about car safety. We're having a discussion about the thing that seems out of our control, despite the fact that the numbers still tell us, and again, like you, I don't want to minimize the tragedy and the pain of the people who do suffer from it, but the numbers tell us that this is simply not as great a problem for the United States as lung cancer, as heart attacks, as driving, as any number of things. We would have to go way down the list before we got to terrorism as a cause of death if we wanted to simply put our resources where we saw the most actual threat to life.
We're speaking this hour with Jeffrey Engel of SMU. If you would like to join our conversation, we'll be taking calls after this break. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about calls to limit immigration from terrorist-controlled regions, including Syria. My guest for this portion of the hour is Jeffrey Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU and author of the upcoming book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Paul on the line in McKinney. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just wanted to talk to your commentator about this notion that we could adequately screen these people and what that really means, if it means anything as far as keeping us safe from people that want to do us harm that come in, and why he thinks somehow we can really do that.
Well, I think we need to remember that the numbers we're talking about are remarkably small at this point. The most that we've heard the president talk about increasing over the next several years are maybe 20, 30,000 refugees. And we need to put that into context of what Europe is facing, where we're seeing almost a million refugees come across the waters in recent months and in projections as well. So each of those people who's going to come in has to be vetted and has to be screened. And it's actually not that big a number for doing that. And it's certainly a smaller number than we see people coming through who need visas, for example. So we have a very, very effective system in place since 9/11 of checking people's credentials and finding out who they are and who they know, and then making sure that we don't admit the wrong person. Now, granted, this is not foolproof. I don't want to suggest that this would be foolproof in any way. It's possible for people to fall through the cracks, if you will. And it's even possible for people to lie their way through the cracks. But we shouldn't think for a moment that people are just, because they're refugees, going to show up unscreened, which is, I think, what a lot of the rhetoric suggests.
The Pew Research Center in 2012 estimated that on an annual basis, the United States was extending permanent citizenship rights to something like 100,000 Muslims per year. It's you know, this past week we've been talking about crime and about terrorism, but it doesn't seem like most of those individuals have been noteworthy for contributing to an increase in violent crime or crime of any kind.
Well, I think that's right. And we also need to remember the context of what happened in San Bernardino. It took several days for the president and other public officials to feel comfortable saying that this was a terrorist act. Now, put aside whether or not you're comfortable with the president's assessment of what terrorism is. The very fact that when the first news reports went out and just said there is a random shooting going on tells us that this is not an unusual thing in American society, sad though it is to say. So the number of people who have been killed by handguns and by assault rifles in random shootings and in mass killings in the United States by natural-born Americans far exceeds anything that we've seen from ISIS.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Brooke on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you were just speaking to a portion of my question. I'm curious about how we could be having a dialogue as absurd as banning a population of people from entering our borders based upon their religious preference when there is accessibility to assault rifles. It's easier for them to access assault rifles than it is to have clearance into our country. And I'm baffled that is focus of the dialogue versus something that seems more attainable as getting these dangerous weapons off of the street for anyone who has a warped purpose in mind.
Brooke, thanks for your call.
You know, I have to say, you and I preach from the same choir. I think that the fact that there are such incredible deadly weapons available to the average citizen, legally or illegally acquired, is really mind-blowing. And we are the only country in the world that permits this by any stretch of the imagination. The kind of places that you could find weaponry like this are the kind of places that people usually flee as refugees. So we need to remember, I think, that the number of people that we're talking about coming in as terrorists, again, it pales in comparison to the number of people who are killed by each other every day. And it really is, I think it's a great tragedy. And I will also say that I think it is no surprise to me and no coincidence that people, especially on the Republican side of the ticket in terms of presidential candidates, are interested in talking about terrorism rather than talking about gun safety or gun control. It's no surprise to me because, frankly, the Republican Party has aligned itself with the NRA and with the promotion of Second Amendment rights as a fundamental value of their ideology. And consequently, the more that they can focus the discussion after large-scale mass killings on an enemy other, on the fact that this is not us that is doing this to ourselves, but this is somebody else. So let's get angry at the somebody else and ignore the vast majority of killings that are done by ourselves. I think that's a very effective strategy for making sure that their agenda on gun rights does not get infringed upon.
To be entirely honest, I've been confused as to why people on, let's just call it both ends of the political spectrum, have sort of spoken about this in a way that would suggest that it's mutually exclusive to either talk about gun safety, gun control, or, looking at with a more skeptical eye at people who are entering the country from abroad.
I think, you know, obviously we want to do both. I mean, we want to do everything. the thing that's important to remember is that these weapons that were just used in San Bernardino and other places were legally acquired. So if we really want to keep, you know, people in this country, if you really – okay, let's face facts. If you're really worried about a refugee – being hidden in the waves of refugees, actually waves is too strong a word, in the groups of refugees that are coming to the United States, if you're really worried about a terrorist embedding themselves in that group, the last thing you should want to do is make it easy for them to get weapons of deadly destruction and mass destruction. You know, if they didn't have access to an assault rifle, then they couldn't pull off their terrorist deed. So you really want to make yourself safe from terrorism in this country, get rid of the guns. Simple.
How, over the centuries and the decades, have Americans sort of chosen the group that is the out-group in terms of immigrant desirability?
Well, what's fascinating is that not only have they chosen out-groups in every generation, but the out-groups in every generation, of course, ultimately become the in-groups. So let me give you one case in point. You know, in the 1860s and 1870s, the group that people really despised and really wanted to keep out of the country were the Irish.
I've never had trouble getting a job.
Well, and that, thank goodness for that. You know, but it took 100 and some odd years for that to happen. Right. Actually, it took very, very short time. It only took until the next otherly different group arrived mm-hmm. for the Irish to become acceptable. There's also an interesting element of race involved here in that, and this is I tell my students this, and they really have trouble getting their mind around it. If you asked a person in the 1850s and 60s and 70s, are the Irish white or black? They would tell you they were black. They would say that they are such an other, that they're a racial other, that they're certainly, if nothing else, not white. Or not white like us, if you will. I say that as somebody whose family came to the United States many decades after the waves of Irish immigration. And so in every generation, we have seen groups be labeled as out-groups, and then essentially they become integrated into American society and fully accepted the moment there is a somewhat more different other group arriving. For the case of the Irish, it was after the great waves of immigration of the 1890s through or up until World War I that came from Eastern Europe, where we saw Slavs and Jews and others who seemed even more different than Western Europeans come into the country. That allowed the Irish and other groups to become essentially part of the American ideal.
Do those newly graduated outgroups who are then accepted into the acceptable sort of American crowd, do they turn around and join the broader culture in shunning the next people historically?
You know, I'd love to say that they recognized how difficult their own history was, and so consequently they turned around and championed the rights of those who came just after them, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that once you are inside the envelope, if you will, of Americanness, it's very easy for people to suddenly see anyone else as an other and to be really more content wrapping themselves in the mantle of inclusiveness which means the inclusiveness of the group they're already in, which now includes, if you will, everyday average Americans. Once they're inside, they usually push away from others getting in.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Walla on the line in Richardson. Hi, Walla.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Good. I would like to express my opinion concerning the blocking of Muslims into entering the U.S. This will be a disastrous decision by the U.S. First of all, we have millions of Muslims already here in the U.S., and we have Muslims running away from terrorism, trying to look for refugee. And if we ill-treat them, how do these Muslims that are here feel? And at the same time, we have people like Donald Trump who have uttered such horrific words, making Muslims that are already here uncomfortable. How do they feel now, walking into the streets, going to shopping malls, and, you know, people looking at them as Muslims? How do they feel? They feel uncomfortable.
You know, let's think about something that Jeb Bush said in the last debate when Donald Trump was complaining about immigration, and in that context, he was complaining about immigration largely from Mexico and Latin America, where he said, you know, the Democrats are standing up and applauding every time you do this. What we need to remember is every time that Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or someone else vilifies the Muslim religion and suggests that there's a problem with the everyday average person who follows Islam as being somehow un-American or dangerous, ISIS cheers. ISIS says this is exactly the kind of message that we want because this helps our recruiting, this helps our funding, and this really makes us be important players on the world scene. We need to remember, I think, take a step back and remember what it was the last time that we fought, if you will, a global war of ideas, which essentially was during the Cold War, where we had the forces of freedom against the forces of communism, which was, by the way, much, much more popular than any kind of Islamic radicalism ever has been, the forces of communism. I mean, we had
And now it seems sort of quaint that we worried about communism.
I mean, half the world thought that this was the way to organize themselves. And frankly, half the world thought they were going to win. If you took a bet in 1956 over which side was going to triumph, you get pretty good odds by saying the communists were eventually going to win. So how did the United States and its allies overcome this difficulty? They did it by standing fast and essentially by standing up and portraying to the rest of the world a model that other people wanted. That they want to be like us. They want to follow the capitalist system. They want to follow our freedoms. They want to align themselves on the side because they saw themselves having a better life in the long term and a better country in the long term if they aligned themselves with the values of the United States. And if we really want to defeat this terrorist threat, we need to recognize that the only way to ultimately defeat it is not through guns, is not through bombing them back to the Stone Ages, because when you bomb one terrorist, you create 10 more because they have relatives. The only way to get rid of people like this in the long term is to get their own communities to recognize that we're falling behind the rest of the world by following this ideology. We need to go with the people who are moving forward in life, which historically has been the United States and its allies.
Is there an example from history? Is there information that you can offer to people who legitimately are afraid, who think that, you know, I should be able to go to work at a place like the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California, do my job for people who are disabled without fear of being gunned down by a terrorism? People who say, we're not talking about in any context turning the other cheek, but people who say they're frightened or angry about these events and they want to feel like they're not doing nothing.
I think there's two ways to answer that, and I don't want to turn this into a conversation about gun control. Though actually, I'd be happy to turn it into a conversation about gun control personally. But you know, I am not worried about terrorism when I go to the movies. I am still worried about being shot when I go to the movies, but not by a terrorist, but by a crazy person in our own midst. So that's a separate issue. So if you really want to worry about how you're likely to die, ISIS is not the thing that you need to worry about. Again, that's not to minimize the deaths and not to minimize the tragedy, but we need to have a little bit of perspective and context on the numbers here. But the second thing is, if we want to do something positive, if we really want to have an agenda to win this conflict, the way that you win the conflict, as I mentioned before, is by getting people to come to your side. It's by demonstrating your strength, not your weakness. It's by demonstrating your power, not your fear. And right now we are telling the world that we are exactly what ISIS says. ISIS says the reason that you need to follow them, if you're in the Muslim world, is because the United States is anti-Muslim. Frankly, you turn on the news today, you get pretty good evidence from the Republican candidates in particular that that's the case. And it's exactly the wrong message to be sending if we actually want to win this war.
Do you think our allies around the world are watching to see what we do about this, how we respond to this latest act of what appears to be Islamic extremist terrorism?
I think most definitely. I mean, we obviously there was no quicker way to get the French on board than to have them unfortunately suffer the tragedy that they did. But we have to remember that we're having a debate right now over what is really a relatively small handful of refugees from war-torn areas in the Middle East coming to our shores in comparison to what is currently going on in Europe. You know, that by definition, when you have an ally, that means you have a common cause and a common bond and you're working towards the same thing. And right now, if we put up our walls even higher and say nobody is getting in who appears to be different in any way, shape, or form, we're not going to suggest to our allies, to the French and to the British and to the rest of Europe and to those in the Middle East who are on our side, that we really have their interest at heart or that we have skin in the game.
Jeffrey Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU, author of the upcoming book, The Four Freedoms, Franklin D. Roosevelt and the Evolution of an American Idea. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Earlier this hour, we heard from Ron Elving at NPR. We want to thank him as well. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.